So today's guest is Joe Navarro, and not many can say they were personally approached to join the FBI, but this is exactly what happened to Joe Navarro while he was working as a police officer at the tender age of 23. He accepted their offer and became one of the youngest agents ever to join the renowned investigative agency. Joe spent the next 25 years at the FBI working both as an agent and a supervisor in the areas of counterintelligence and counterterrorism. Through his work, he was able to study, refine, and apply the science of nonverbal communications. His acumen in this field and his success as a spy catcher led Joe to begin training FBI agents in the intelligence community. Retiring from the FBI in 2003 and meeting overwhelming demand for his notable insights into human behavior, Joe has dedicated himself to speaking and consulting with major corporations worldwide. Today, Joe is recognized as one of the world's foremost authorities on reading nonverbal communication and is regularly interviewed on programs such as NBC's Today Show, Fox News, ABC's Good Morning America, CBS's Early Show, and for publications such as The Washington Post and Psychology Today. So welcome, Joe. We're delighted to have you here with us today.
It's good to be here. It's a beautiful day in Tampa, and I hope it's a beautiful day wherever your listeners are.
It's always a beautiful day in Tampa, I suspect. So let's get started. This is a subject that fascinates people. Whenever I do presentations and talk to people, I always get asked about nonverbal communication. So first of all, let's define, what is nonverbal communication when we use that word today?
Well, that's a great question to start with because there is some confusion out there. Nonverbal communication includes anything and everything that sends us a message but is not a word. So we can look at a red flag on the street and probably deduce that, oh, there's some issue coming up ahead. There's a message. Or we can see somebody raise their right hand in our face and sort of say stop. Without saying the word, that sends us a message. It's symbolic. But there's other things about us that send out messages. For instance, when people get dressed up to go to church or get dressed up to go to a wedding, it says we care about something. We care enough that we're going to get dressed up in special clothes and so forth. We're going to behave a certain way. One of the interesting things that we find is when people dress up, they tend to behave better than when they don't. So these things are considered nonverbals, as well as the body language. And that's just one component of nonverbal communication. And then we have things such as how a company looks, how a company presents, well, hopefully we'll talk about later, such as curbside appeal, and what that transmits to the public about whether or not they should come inside and do business there and so forth. So it's a very broad term, but body language is specific to just that. But there's a lot more nonverbal. And unfortunately, sometimes people talk about body language as though it were the term kinesics. Kinesics is a term that was very popular in the 1970s and early 80s, but kinesics merely has to do with body movement. It doesn't have anything to do with body expressions. It doesn't have to do with micro expressions. It doesn't have to do with the muscles relaxing in the face and what that means. So it's a term that has its place, but it's very limited. So that, in essence, is what nonverbal communications is about.
So kinesics is a subset of body language, is what you're telling me.
Exactly. Okay. It's really the study of body movement, but it doesn't really look at things. For instance, when the nose dilates or pupils dilate, that doesn't fall within kinesics. Kinesics falls under body language.
Gotcha.
But I still see people out there saying, hey, are you an expert on kinesics? And I say, no, I'm not. That's a whole different other science.
Got it. So of human communication, how much of it is verbal and how much of it is nonverbal? Because I know if I'm talking to my wife, sometimes she doesn't have to say anything and I'm getting the message. Or she's saying one thing and I'm thinking, that's not really what she's saying. So how does that work?
Yeah, Paul, you're lucky because my wife says you better be getting the message. And I love her dearly, but she constantly looks at me and she says, stop it, you're studying me. I go, no, no, that's not true. A lot of what we communicate between each other is really nonverbal. Now, I've heard figures, everything from 50 to 60 to 90% is nonverbal. And you know what? It may be right, but it depends on circumstances. If you're dating somebody, you would be surprised at how much of it is nonverbal. A lot of it has to do with the chemistry, the body chemistry. It has to do with body posture. It has to do with the nonverbals of the gaze and so forth, how we look at each other. This is an area that nobody can say there's a specific number because it's very situational. Even in the business setting, it may be 50 to 60%. And at times, when you get a CEO that stands in front of a group and apologizes for something, the message may be as high as 90% of what the body says. And then there may be a technical meeting where it's only 5% or 10%. But one thing we know is, in spite of all the electronic means of communication, nonverbal communications are essential for effective interpersonal communication.
Yeah, and that brings, you just brought up an interesting point, the electronic communication we use today, such as email, and of course you've got a Twitter account, I do, and you reduce it down to just, 160 characters. What happens to the communication when we strip out all the nonverbals like that?
Well, and that's a great question, because we do see problems. Well, number one is we see the attempt to correct that by having the smiley face, so that when we say something, we're basically saying, don't take this wrong, I mean this in a good way. What's that doing? Well, that's providing emotion. Well, emotions are nonverbal. They're not verbal. But this is something that's getting a lot of people, especially young people, jammed up, because they don't realize it's a huge component of nonverbals, and so their messages are being taken sometimes in the wrong way, because there is no way to detect what emotion or what's the intent that's being sent. In fact, I've run into that a couple of times where I've taken on my Twitter account, Navarro Tells, I've asked people to clarify something, because the first time I heard it, I thought they were maybe picking a fight with me. And they come back and they say, oh, no, we were just joking. Now, if we were standing in front of each other, that wouldn't even be an issue, because we can pick up on those nonverbals. But this is definitely, and I've also heard this from corporations, where emails just sometimes doesn't cut it. And in spite of this, this past 2 years where the economy has been down in the dumps, the fact of the matter is that corporations are still having to get together. And the reason that they do, the reason that they have these large meetings and they have these gatherings and getaways and so forth, is because there's something magical about being face-to-face with your other company associates and sharing information in a way that is not verbal. And that simply, even with Skype, that's just something that will never go away.
I know what you're saying, because we've all had that experience, I think, of saying something via email and getting a completely wrong reaction, or where they don't answer back at all, and you're wondering what happened. Is that good or bad?
Sure.
You can't tell because you can't see them.
Paul, we have to remember, if we go with science, and we are somewhere derived from the early Australopithecines, so for about 4 to 3.5 million years, we have been communicating nonverbally to each other quite effectively. It's only in the last maybe 100,000 years that we began to sort of develop this Broca's area of the brain where we can effectively talk to each other. So for a very long time, and certainly babies know how to do this, and mothers, we've been communicating through this very silent language of nonverbal.
So is nonverbal learned, or is it born with us?
That's a great question, because there's science that leads us both ways. Primarily, we're born to just sort of sponge up information. We begin to collect information, nonverbal and verbal, while we're still in the uterus. There's a wonderful study that came out just last year from Europe, where they found that when babies are born, at the very second they're born and they're crying, they cry with the sort of lilt of their native tongue. So German babies will cry with a certain tone, and French babies cry with a certain tone. So already they're primed for learning. They're picking up information that's going to be vital later on, because this mirroring of the master language that they're hearing is going to help them to adapt later. So that's socialized. Those things they learn. And we learn a lot of things. But many things, especially when it comes to the nonverbal language, is actually innate. And I'll give you an example. We know, for instance, that, and you've often seen, you ask someone a favor, and you say, can you help me this weekend to move? And you'll see them cover their eyes, and they go, I'll do that. And that covering of the eyes is really a blocking behavior. They'll do it, but they'd rather not. Here's what's interesting. When they've done studies with children who were born blind, when they hear things they don't like, they also cover their eyes. What's wonderful about these studies that have been done with blind children is we see what behaviors are innate. They're born with these behaviors. There's no way they can learn them because they haven't seen it or experienced it. And so we know that, for instance, at a minimum, all emotions come to us through our DNA, let's say. And there's a lot of other behaviors that also come to us innately. For instance, there's something I wrote about in the book, What Everybody is Saying. And I gave it the term ventral denial. And, you know, we have our backside, our dorsal side, and our stomach side, our ventral side. And one of the things that I had noticed over 30 years of study was that, when people don't care for each other or they're upset with each other, they deny each other their belly. You know, they turn away. And in essence, the extreme of that is he turned his back on me or she turned her back on me. Well, in studying this over 30 years, I noticed that little children at a very young age also do this. They'll cross their arms and they'll turn and give their parents their back. So they do this ventral denial. Started talking to colleagues who study children who are blind, and they said, yeah, we see them doing the same thing. We don't know where they get it because they've never seen it. It's fascinating. So these behaviors come to us through nature. And why is that? Because I think it's important. I think it was important in the days when we did not communicate through words that the group understand how we felt emotionally, how we felt about our environment. Were we too cold, too hot? When we felt threatened, when one member of the group maybe saw a large feline, a lion or a tiger, when that person froze, it was important for the whole group to act the same way. So this mimicry of behavior, what we call isopraxis or mirroring, which is so essential for survival, as it turns out, is really essential for business, and it's also essential for instance, dating, which is why when you're at a cafe and you see a young man and he's leaning forward and he's gazing with his head tilted towards his girlfriend, she's doing the same thing. This isopraxis or mirroring is reflecting the power of nonverbal communications to say, here we are in synchrony. We are as one with our body language and therefore with our thought.
So I want to get into some specific tools that my listeners can use, but I have one more question in this area first, and that is, how universal is this across culture? In other words, you're talking about turning the back and things like that. Is this cross-cultural, or are there cultural-specific nonverbals that people need to be aware of?
The most asked question I think I get is, well, how much of this is culturally driven? Well, we know that emotions are all driven by the limbic part of the brain. That's the survival reactive part of the brain. This is the part of the brain that Gavin De Becker, the great author, wrote about in The Gift of Fear. that it never lets us down and reacts to the world. So around the world, a smile is a smile, a frown is a frown, lip compression is indicative of some sort of stress and so forth. But then we pick up social conventions as far as our body language. For instance, in Latin America, it is customary for people to stand closer and to touch each other as they're talking, as is in many of the Mediterranean countries. Obviously, this is socially derived. Mm-hmm. And yet, we teach this to each other. And yet, within those cultures, you'll still find people that maybe feel uncomfortable if you touch them too much or feel uncomfortable if you stand too close to them. To a large extent, we are primarily communicating through this subconscious knowledge, universal knowledge that we have, and it's been tested over time. I mean, when our seafarers went all over the world, they primarily communicated non-verbally, not verbally. But I think society also teaches us to behave certain ways, and so that certainly is a factor. I'll say one thing that's kind of interesting, if I may, from a historical perspective. As I looked at the history of sailors around the world and how they communicated nonverbally, one of the interesting records that I found was an original record by somebody that had traveled to the Americas with the original Spanish conquistadores. When they arrived in Mexico, the record reflects, his name was Bernal Diaz, that they saw the same things in America, in the Americas, that they had seen in Queen Isabella's court. What were those things? People of high status behaved differently. They behaved more dignified. They had better clothing. They were granted greater space. They sat higher. Their clothing was more colorful. That people around them tended to bow down before them, that they had a more eloquence of speech, and that they sort of set the tone for what everybody else did. It's the same behaviors that they had just seen 3 months earlier in the Spanish court, and they were just sort of blown away by, hey, this isn't too dissimilar. And so it is sort of universal.
All right, so that kind of gives us a background on nonverbal communication. Let's get over into the business world now and start applying this. What can nonverbal communication help us to achieve in the business world?
Think about things such as conveying honesty. Think about things such as conveying authority, conveying leadership, conveying veracity, conveying that you are trustworthy, that you are efficient. When we think about those things, and all those things are part and parcel of business, of leadership, all of those things we do nonverbally. You don't stand in front of a group and say, hi, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Joe Navarro. I'm honest, and I'm your leader today. Now they follow like lemmings. It doesn't work that way. In fact, when I studied the great leaders of industry, well, one of the ones that really stood out for me, for instance, on many boards, is the former general, Colin Powell. And I don't know if you've ever been in his presence, and I have. When he walks into a room, he commands the room. He takes your breath away. You know that he's a leader. You know that you can trust him. And he hasn't even spoken yet. Mm-hmm. And you say, how does he do that? He does that with his nonverbals. He just carries himself in such a way. And those that have worked for him say the same thing. This is a man that you gravitate towards, this individual, because he has mastered the nonverbals of success. Leaders, they move smoothly. Leaders are not jittery. Leaders don't need to lose their voice, high pitch. They don't need to lose control of themselves. They command the space where they speak from. They don't hide behind a lectern. All these things communicate to us, and they're communicated not through words, but through body language.
I've been in a room where there was probably 400 people, and the typical party cocktail, light cocktail, hors d'oeuvres type of party, and Bill Clinton came in the room, and nobody had to say that he was there. The whole room just knew it instantly as soon as he walked in the door. It was quite an amazing thing to experience.
Yes, and it's I've heard the same thing. I was very fortunate to have met him through my work and to meet someone, for instance, like Henry Kissinger, Henry Kissinger and I were both in Connecticut giving a speech at the same location. I got to talk to him. You couldn't keep people away from Henry Kissinger. And he's not a very tall man. He's not the a replica of David. And yet he draws people. And the only explanation I had for this is he, and this I think was very helpful to him, because when I spoke to him about the Middle East, he said, you know, the Middle East and diplomacy is about nuance. And he said, nuance is about the kinds of things that you talk about, which is body language. It's about that handshake that lingers a little longer. It's about that touching of the shoulder that's warm and comforting. It's about that look that doesn't look away, that lets you know that you're the most important thing to me right now. Those things, as a diplomat, were supremely important to him. And at the same time, they're instructive to us because, you know, there's no need to reinvent these things. Really, the best that we can do is mirror these behaviors that are tried and true and serve great leaders so well.
So clearly being good at nonverbal communication, whether it's learned or innate, gives somebody an advantage in the business world. So can you give my listeners some specific tips as to how they can have the appearance of confidence and strength when they enter a room or when they talk to somebody?
Sure. It's a very fair question because we can learn these things. The research tells us that we can enhance our understanding and use of nonverbals. And Shakespeare said, life is theater, and it's a performance, and to a certain extent, it is. And one of the things that I learned in interviewing military personnel over the years was how much theatrical work they really have to do. I mean, a drill sergeant has to be theatrical. A colonel has to present a certain way to the audience, and they say, you know, this doesn't happen. We actually have to rehearse it in the same way that we did the same thing in the FBI. Can't tell you how many times I went on a case, and I never even showed my credentials, just my bearing and my appearance. Opened doors and got people to
Did you work on that when you were in training in the FBI? Did they teach you that, or did you discover it and then teach it to others? Does the FBI practice this?
Well, you observe it in others. You observe it in the people that train you. That, for instance, the way we walk into a room, it's purposeful, but we're not fidgeting. Our hands are not, you see this sometimes where somebody walks into a room and all their hands are full. One thing you notice is a good leader carries very few things in his hands. In fact, years ago, Jimmy Carter was criticized because he used to carry his own luggage, and everybody around the world said, you're a leader. You don't do that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he was trying to be everybody's man, but he just doesn't understand that there's a certain way to behave as a leader. And so when you look at the president next time or the prime minister or the queen, you'll always notice that rarely do they have anything in their hands. You'll notice that their movements are fluid. That's one of the things that we learn in the Bureau. Smooth is fast. Your movements have to be fluid because they engender confidence. If you're jittery and your arms are moving and dashing and you're grabbing this and you're moving towards that, that does not convey confidence. One of the things you learn is when you're rescuing people, you want to be smooth and fast, but you don't want to be erratic. Posture, the way that you walk into the room, posture is what we use to determine health and vitality. The posture of our approach to the room, how we walk in and so forth, says a lot about us. How organized we are. That we act like we don't know where we put things and so forth. Disorganized behavior, if you videotape it and turn the sound off, everybody will be rated poorly if they can't find their paperwork, if they take too long and so forth. Behaviors of discomfort, such as lip biting, neck scratching, shirt ventilating, things that display that we are struggling with something or that we are having anxiety, these are not the nonverbals of leadership. Now, that doesn't mean that And I still get this. I was in Vegas a couple of days ago, and I was giving a speech. And as I'm getting ready to get into the room, once again, I always get this. I had the butterflies, and I was a little nervous. That doesn't mean that these things are going to go away. It just means that we have to master them. We have to control them so that that saying used to say, they don't see you sweat. Because what people will draw from you will primarily be based on your nonverbals. And of course, we want them to see us as leaders. We want them to see us as honest and authentic and forthright and so forth. And all that is done through nonverbal communication.
How can we help somebody to know that we're honest and forthright then? Not how can we lie to them, but if we are honest and forthright, how can we ensure that they actually get that message instead of a contradictory message?
Well, you know, and there's a couple of ways that we can do this. Number one is we do it through performance. Performance is the number one way that we can show to others that we care and that we mean what we say by complying with things and doing them on time. Here's another one, moving to action on their behalf immediately. This is one of the best ways to let people know that we care. When we attend to things that benefit them the most, they immediately get it because these are the same behaviors that we looked for in our parents, in our mothers, when she immediately went and got the bottle for us because we were hungry. That registers with us, oh, this person really cares. And this person is very honest, and we attribute these positive things. So when we say we're going to do something, and the performance of it, how we perform it, the eagerness with which we would perform it, the look on our face when we receive the information and we comply with it, this begins to demonstrate that we're honest. Now, there's some things that we find, for instance, with our own clothing that affects this. We find from the research that when somebody wears a suit, and it's a two-button suit, so there's more of the chest area that's visible, they're perceived as more honest than a person that wears a three-button suit. And if you've noticed, three-button suits, they close very high. What I tell students and people who attend my seminars is the more you look like Stalin or you look like Chairman Mao, the less trustful you're going to be seen. And that's why you see politicians usually wear only a two-button suit instead of a three-button suit. Romney from Massachusetts is one of the ones that has mastered this because you're obviously perceived as more honest.
Or they take off their suit coat completely. Does that open it up even further?
And that's part of it. And that's part of it is to take the coat off and say, here I am, totally exposed, part of you. And you say, does that really influence us? Absolutely. The research is there. Put somebody in front of someone else in a three-button suit, which are unfortunately very popular, and they seem sort of closed off and distant. And yet, when you put them in that two-button suit, when you ask students about that, they say, oh, yeah, he seems more open, he seems more relaxed, and so forth. So even clothing affects how we're perceived.
So nonverbals can obviously help us to decipher what people are thinking, feeling, intending. So can you give me some examples of nonverbals that we can read in other people to help us figure out what they're thinking and feeling?
Well, sure. And actually there's four areas that working on yet another book from the research, we can sort of tell when people are thinking, feeling, desiring, and intending from their nonverbals. So let me give you some examples. Let me start with intending and work backwards because you'll find this useful. You see two people at a business meeting. They're standing in their hallway. They're having a great conversation. All of a sudden, one of them points their right toe, turns their right foot towards the hallway elevator. Now, if you're socially competent, you'll pick up on that immediate tell, on that immediate behavior, which is, it's really called an intention cue. What that person is saying, look, as much as I like talking to you here, I have to go. And the limbic brain, and this very primitive part of our brain, and yet it's very elegant, has immediately communicated this need by orienting the foot in that direction and saying, I need to be going fairly soon here. And this is done subconscious. Even the person whose foot turns away most of the time doesn't realize that this has happened to them. And so here the brain, through our body, is revealing intentions, I need to leave. In the same way that sometimes you're sitting in a meeting and you'll see somebody lean forward, their feet get placed in the starter's position, and their hands are on their knees, and obviously they need to leave at the moment. The meeting's over. And that's one of the intentions that we can read. Desires. For instance, you often see this with children, but I've also seen this with executives, where they walk by an office and they see, ooh, there's a Herman Miller chair, and you see the arches of their eyes, where the eyebrows are, it arches up. This is called a gravity-defying behavior. This says, I really like this. It's the same behavior as when someone walks in the room and you arch your eyebrows and you go, hey, how are you? It communicates a desire. Well, this is a behavior that our mothers immediately pick up on us when we're hungry. And if you're breastfeeding and so forth, you have the same behavior from the baby. It also reveals our emotions. For instance, you see someone, they realize all of a sudden that, yes, we're going to Disney World. And you see their feet get really happy. They get happy feet and they're bouncing. Clearly, this is an emotional display. It's universal that the person is happy and content. So we're reading emotions there. And then the last one is, well, what about thoughts? Well, how many times have you seen someone who is walking out the door and all of a sudden stops, hits their forehead with their palm, and turns around and goes back into the house? They forgot something. They forgot something. So nonverbals reveal a lot about what's going on in our minds. And the beauty of it is, it's in real time. There is no delay. We don't think something, and then our body language reflects it an hour later. We reflect it right now.
So you've coined a term called curbside appeal. Tell us about curbside appeal, how we can use that, how that benefits us. What's that all about?
About 20 years ago, I was shopping for a house, and for the first time, maybe it's longer than that, maybe 30 years ago, I'm getting along. I heard the term, and I didn't coin it, but somebody said, oh, well, you know, we need to improve, or this house needs to improve its curbside appeal. And I said, why? I said, well, they just put some plants up front, it would be more appealing. And that term stuck with me because a lot of times companies don't think about what is their curbside appeal. And this is what I write about in the book, What Everybody, in Louder Than Words. And I said, think about all the banks that are out there. All the banks are up against the same prime lending rate. So what makes us choose one over another? In the neighborhood near where I live, there's literally one bank in every corner. Now, how do we choose that? And a lot of that has to do with the curbside appeal. Which one looks safe? Which one looks lit up at night? Which one has litter in the bushes? Which one needs to be trimmed and never seems to get trimmed? Which one has the dirty windows and so forth? And one of the things that I found was how often we gravitate to the things that look safe, they look clean, and they look organized. And then I looked at some of the research that had been done years ago on gas stations. And I don't know if you've ever noticed, but some gas stations are really well lit up. I mean, you can see them from miles and miles away, especially out west in the desert. And what they found was the more lights you put in a gas station, the safer it looked, the greater the curbside appeal. It didn't matter that the gas station across the way was cheaper. There's something to be said for what we call psychological comfort. And that comfort is derived from a gas station that's well-lit and is clean. And so we prefer to go there, even though it's slightly more expensive than the place across the way. And so that's why I talked about curbside appeal, because you can have a company's curbside appeal, but then, as you know, there's also personal curbside appeal.
Let's continue down that line then. So how can individuals improve their curbside appeal?
Individual curbside appeal is something that we can all work on, and we can do that by taking an honest look at ourselves and saying, all right, if I hold up a mirror to Joe Navarro, what do I look like? Am I wearing the same suit that I was wearing 13 years ago? Is that shirt the same shirt that I've worn for the last 8 years, and so the collar is now yellow, not white? What about the tie? What about the shoes? What about my haircut? What is my overall curbside appeal? Because we do influence people by how we present. Do I need a haircut? Do I need to change the haircut? What about my nails? Maybe we know from the research that long nails on men are awful. Everybody hates them. And yet, how often do we see a man with very long nails, or they're dirty and so forth? The next thing we need to look at is, well, what's our behavior? Am I behaving as a leader, or am I behaving as a follower? And there are behaviors of the follower. The behaviors of the follower are individuals who really have very little situational awareness. They seem to walk down the hall with their head looking down at their feet. They make no effort to greet, to attend to other people, to socialize and so forth. And this takes away from them. When you look at yourself, one of the things that you have to do is, what is my curbside appeal? And would I appeal to someone? One of the questions that I was asked repeatedly this past year was having to do with, how can I change how I am perceived because I need to find a job for the first time in 15 years? And I said, you know, that's a great question. One of the things that you need to do is, do you look your best? And that doesn't mean you have to be beautiful. That just means, do you look professional? Do you look as the, do you look sharp? And that's important. By the way, there's some interesting.
You use the words nonverbal comfort. What do you mean by nonverbal comfort?
We thrive when we have this psychological nonverbal comfort. We don't like it when people invade our space. That causes us tension. We like it when, we know from the research, we like people to look like us, talk like us, think like us. I'll never forget the first time I went to a deli in New York. At the deli there, people were talking very fast. And I'm talking in my South Florida, sort of slower. And you know, you could see the frustration on this poor man's face. You know, come on, here, we're in New York. We do things fast. But I mean, you know, that type of thing. So we become frustrated when things don't mirror us. And we derive comfort when things sound like we do. They speak the same way. And we want to mirror those things as best we can because they provide psychological comfort. Now, psychological comfort was huge in the FBI because this is how we get people to talk to us. We actually make them feel comfortable. You know, all that Jack Bauer stuff and 24 and pressure and the interview tactics you see on TV are just trash. They're absolute trash. What actually works best is create comfort, because think about how many times you've forgotten where your keys are or you've forgotten something. You were probably under stress. When our brains are relaxed, we think more clearly. I tell this to business people. Create psychological comfort for your employees. Create psychological comfort for your clients. And they will want to spend more time with you. They will come to visit you more often, and they will increase face time with you.
Can we increase our nonverbal comfort then? How did you do it in the FBI, and how can we use those techniques in business?
The way we increased this psychological comfort was You welcome somebody into the room and you immediately assess how much space do they need. Oh, you're from Latin America. I'll sit closer to you. Oh, you're from Western Europe. I'll sit a little bit further away from you and let you adjust to me. Don't sit directly in front of your client. People think, oh, I should sit directly in front of them. No, that's the most tense way to sit. The best way to sit with a client is to sit at an angle, so you're not directly in front of each other. Try to mirror the pace at which they talk. If the person likes to talk fast, don't slow it down. Try to match the speed at which they talk. On the verbal side, try to mirror the words that they use. If they use the words family, don't say wife and kids. That's not what they said. They said family. If the person you're talking to said home, don't say house. That's not what they said. And what we find from the research is when you mirror their words, the rewards are fabulous. There was a study that was just released this year that was done in Europe. And it was done with waitresses. And the waitresses were told, whatever the order is given to you, repeated verbatim. Now, the other half of the wait staff was said, you take that order any way you want. And here's what's interesting. The waitresses that repeated verbatim what the client said had a 140% increase. That's a 140% increase in tips. Now, why is that? Because by mirroring the words that were said, we create psychological comfort. Ah, this person gets it. When I go see my financial advisor and I say, you know, I have a real problem with this community, with the economy, and he comes back and says, yeah, there's some issues there. Whoa, slow down. No, that's not what I said. First of all, my generation had problems. We didn't have issues. Your generation has issues. And that's not the word that I said. So by merely mirroring my words, somebody can establish empathetic channels of communication. By mirroring my body posture, he or she puts me at ease. And so we can use these, and basically this is what Louder Than Words is really about. How do we put somebody at ease? How do we establish rapport? How do we establish psychological comfort? So number one, they want to spend more time with us. The more time people spend with us, the more likely they are to spend their money with us. And how do we get them to come back to us? And that's part of using the nonverbals.
Give us an example of something that people don't generally know about body language. Give us some kind of an interesting fact or tidbit that people really aren't aware about with regard to body language and nonverbals.
I'll give you two. One has to do with the body, and one has to do with just nonverbals in essence. I told you, Paul, put your hands on top of the desk. You probably have no idea how you put those hands down. But here's what's interesting. When a person is confident, the space between the fingers is wider. But when they lack confidence, the space narrows so that the fingers come together. In the same way that of your listeners who have dogs will notice, when a dog is threatened, they put their ears down. Humans do the same thing. When we are threatened by the truth, when we're threatened by situations, when we don't feel confident, the space between our fingers narrows. When we're confident, it widens. What's the application of that? When you are talking to a group and you're trying to sell them on a product, or you're trying to motivate them, you want to have those hands very visible, and you want those fingers spread out just as fast as you, just as wide as you can, because that communicates to them, I am supremely confident. Most people don't realize that. Most of this is not even in the literature. Another aspect of this that people don't think about, and that is that how fast we move to action reflects how much we care. I'll give you an example of what happened this year with Toyota and with BP. Both companies were perceived as not moving fast enough. One, Toyota with the recalls, and secondly, BP with the oil spill. When we fail to move to action on a corporate level, people get very, very angry, because when we were babies and we cried because we were wet or hungry, when our mothers moved quickly to take care of us, that began to set the paradigm or the model for, oh, this is movement to action. She's doing this in my behalf. When we go to a company and they don't move to action quickly, it begins to register with us very negatively. And this happens often, for instance, when you go to a company, won't name them, but you go in, they have a big warehouse, and they got all these great products at a very low price. But when you go to check out, there's only one lane open. We've all experienced this. They're saying that they care about your money, but they don't care about you, because they're not moving to action to expedite you leaving the place. And that is one of the things that hurts a lot of businesses. They think that it's just about the money, when psychological comfort tells us that getting you expeditiously out of the store is really more powerful, and even if you charge more, people are willing to go along with that. Wow. Movement to action can be corporate, but it's also interpersonal. You walk into an office, and you will feel better, Paul, if that person behind the desk steps away from the desk, comes over to you, and shakes your hand. How much different that from when you walk into an office and you have to walk all the way over to where they're seated and you have to go to them. Their failure to move to action on your behalf, what it says is, I really don't care. Because all our lives we're surrounded by people who care, and we know that they care because they move to action.
So little things make a huge difference, don't they? And we need to pay attention to this, obviously.
Very well said. There is nothing that is too small, because we are sensitive to very minute things. For instance, you walk in and see a group of people, and let's say all three of them, all of a sudden their faces alight, they smile, their eyebrows arch, and they come over to you and they welcome you. How different that is from you walk into a room and you feel like you're the fifth wheel, that, you know, you've got to sort of cautiously walk over to say hello. How you felt at that moment will stay with you throughout that meeting, and maybe even longer. Here's something interesting from the research. Things that make us feel positive last anywhere from a few hours to maybe a few days. But things that make us feel very negative can last anywhere up to 12 years.
Wow.
12 years. And that's why when you bring up something like, oh, I got my car towed. Yeah, my car was towed in 78. That was a bad experience. How do you remember that? Because negative things, this is important, negative things go to the part of the brain, the hippocampus, where things like burning your finger register for a very long time for survival purposes. So I tell business people, you've got to be thinking about potential negative experiences and negating those, because those will stay longer. And now some research has been done about what people will put on the internet and Twitter about. About 1% of the time, they will communicate positive events, but 37% of the time, they'll talk about negative events. Huh. And that can really hurt a business when there are these little things that can be corrected. You know what's interesting, Paul, is all these things are very inexpensive to correct.
But they have a huge impact, don't they? Yeah.
They have a tremendous impact. Good manners. good manners are nonverbals, and that has a tremendous impact. How somebody shakes your hand, do they shake it too vigorously? Do they shake it too hard? Do they cover your hand with two hands, which is called a politician's handshake, and I hope no one listening to the show will ever do that to somebody else. It's the worst handshake we can do. If you feel like you have to touch the other person, additionally, shake their hand and touch their elbow, but do not.
Tell my listeners how to shake hands. This is something that people really need to know. How's the best way to do that?
First of all, it's to think about handshaking as cultural. So there are many cultures where the handshake is very weak. And there are some cultures, for instance, if you go to the American West, if you go to Utah, there they have what's called the Mormon handshake, which is a very sort of aggressive, very tight, very powerful handshake. You see the same thing in Texas and so forth. And that's part of that culture. And that's important to respect. But you go to other parts of the country, maybe an air kiss or a hug or an abrazo in Miami and so forth. So what's the best way? Well, in business, you want to mirror the person of the higher status. So when you greet them, first of all, create a little bit of extra space. You go in, you shake hands, and immediately you sense what they want. If they have a weak handshake, don't try to squeeze blood out of it. Just squeeze it the same way. Don't grimace. Make the handshake as comfortable as the other person appears to be. And then you stand and just take a small step back and see if the person wants to stay there or move closer to you, or you'll find some people actually want to move further away. You certainly see this in Asia, and I've seen it in Norway and in Sweden. They want a little bit more space. That's fine. Let them become comfortable with that, because if you violate space, if you violate the rules of that first handshake, and yours is too strong or too obsessive and so forth, that leaves negative feelings with that person. And those set the mood for the rest of the day.
How long does it take for somebody to form an opinion of you? When somebody meets you, how long before they jump to a conclusion?
That's a great question. You know, years ago, I remember books being written about the first four minutes and so forth. And I remember as an FBI agent coming into a house or having a suspect come into the interview room and realizing just how quickly we were conducting these assessments. And I said, it's not 4 minutes. Well, sure enough, some researchers in the 90s started looking at this, and they found that we actually assess each other quite accurately in the 80th percentile in about 4 seconds. I'll say that again, in the first 4 seconds, and with some people it's in the first 1 or 2 seconds, that we assess for attitude, that we assess for willingness to cooperate, that we assess for vitality, that we assess for trustworthiness. And you say, my God, is it that short? And is it that accurate? What they found was, in spite of all that stuff about don't judge a book by its cover, which you must not do, when it comes to humans, and it makes sense. We've been doing this for millions of years. We assess each other very quickly. And obviously, the more socially competent you are, the better you'll do this. But in the first 4 seconds, we do a quick, thin-sliced assessment of each other and how we're going to feel about each other. Now, hopefully, if you are socially competent, you will either add to it or detract as you spend more time with the individual. I mean, we've all met some individuals that at first they seem closed off, and then we learn that they're just shy, and so we adjust to that. The current research tells us that about 4 seconds. This is a remarkably small piece of time.
Give me some examples of people who our listeners might know about who they're very effective at using nonverbals, maybe some business leaders or some politicians.
Let's start with the easier ones because we see them often now. When we look at people such as our military leaders, you know, I already mentioned
Colin Powell, but when we look at General Petraeus and other individuals, we see how they carry themselves, and we notice that there's a certain intensity to them and so forth, and they walk with a certain character, and that transmits information to us. But even our politicians, no matter how you feel about them, for CBS News in 2008, I was asked to do a lot of the nonverbal analysis for the presidential debates. And in one of the debates, we had Sarah Palin and we had Joe Biden and so forth. And I commented on the fact that here was Sarah Palin, for the first time she's talking to a global audience, because I was actually in Europe watching it at the time. And no matter how you feel about her, she has a great stage presence. She's very charismatic. She's very photogenic. She has a lot of appeal that way. And these are nonverbals. If you ask people, and it's kind of interesting, well, what was it that she said? Most people can't recall everything that she said, but they remember the nonverbals, which takes me to President Obama has terrific nonverbals. First of all, he's very thin. We're attracted to thin people and tall people. The research behind this is unquestionable. But when you look at his gestures, he has great gestures. He uses his hands a lot. And notice this, when he climbs up the stairs of Air Force One, rarely, unless he's with his wife, rarely does he walk up the stairs. He bounds up the stairs. We've never had a president that did that. And it shows us just how much energy he has. And that's a nonverbal, going back to the Kennedy-Nixon debate. And those that listened to the debate on the radio, which at the time was really the primary way we got our news, everybody that listened to the radio thought that Nixon had won the 1962 debate. They thought that with all his experience as a vice president and all his foreign travel, that he just had outperformed Kennedy. Kennedy on television looked radiant. He had a suntan. He looked youthful. He looked taller than Nixon. He was well shaved. He used makeup. His hair was very well kept. And so those people who listened to that debate on television, or who saw it on television, rated Kennedy higher. And that, in effect, that's what changed political coverage in the future, because people found that, ooh, the nonverbals, how a person looks, really does affect our perception of them. And it's been studied clearly. This is one of the things that put Kennedy on top, even though Nixon had far more experience than Kennedy did.
All right, we're going to wrap this up. I just want to ask you two final questions. And the first one is, can you give me an example of something that maybe people wouldn't normally consider to be a nonverbal, but it really is?
The tone of voice. The tone at which you speak is definitely a nonverbal. They associate it with being a verbal, but it's not. And one of the things that we find that good leaders, in fact, great leaders, rather than raise their voice, lower their voice. By lowering their voices, they actually get people to lean forward, and it has a sort of mesmerizing effect on an audience. It's a powerful way to get people to listen to you. And it establishes you as a true leader by, unless it's a pep rally, by lowering your voice, which is a nonverbal.
So let's wrap it up. I know my listeners would be fascinated with a story from your FBI days. Tell us a great story about how you used nonverbals to solve a case or further your work in the FBI.
Well, I appreciate that question. I was working on an espionage case in 1989, and true story, it's been in the media. The fellow I was interviewing I interviewed him approximately 50 times, but during one of the interviews, he revealed that something extremely sensitive had been compromised by himself to the former Soviet bloc. And when I confronted him with that revelation, I said, appreciate you coming forward with that. You didn't have access to that. That means that other people gave that to you. And he said, well, they did, but I'm not willing to name them because I know I'm going to jail. I don't want them to go to jail. So then it became a matter of, well, who are these people? But he's not willing to tell us. A young analyst I was working with named Mark Reeser said to me, Joe, why don't you use the nonverbals and see if you can get it out of him? So here's what we did. We found out who had access to this very sensitive material, and we put their names on 3x5 cards, one name per card. And so at the next interview, I flashed these in front of this young spy, and I just asked him to talk to me about each one of these individuals, and there were 32 of them. And on two of the cards, what I noticed was that his eyes squinted and that his pupils got smaller. We identified these two individuals. We then came back to him a few days later and said, tell me about this individual and tell me about that individual. And his eyes got big as saucers. And he says, how did you know? I never told him this, but I said, you revealed it to me. You see, when we don't like something or something can hurt us, our eyes squint and our pupils get small. And when I presented him with the 3x5 cards on just those two cards, those were the co-conspirators with him that could hurt him. And that's why his body reacted that way. And we went out, located these individuals. They confessed, and they both got 18 years of prison.
Good, good. Well, thanks for doing that job for our country. We appreciate that. Our listeners, I know now, are eager to get access to more of this information. We've just scratch the surface, so to speak. So how can they get access to more of the information you've got and the training that you provide?
Well, thank you for having me. They can access this information by going to my website, which is www.jnforensics, that's jnforensics.com. And all my books, all my videos, even my online training courses there. And they can also access my books, all 10 of them now, on Amazon by just typing in my name, Joe Navarro, and that will take them to all the books, including the very specific Kindle books. I've put together 6 or 7 books just for Kindle as a favor to them to get the technology going. So that's how they can access my material.